We shall now begin with the oral argument against the United States against Del Rosa. Here first, the counsel for the appellant.
Good afternoon. You may approve the court. You may have Brian Horn, director of the appellant, Gustavo Del Rosa. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I have reserved 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Appellant unambiguously invoked his right to remain in silence when he wrote no in response to a written question of whether he wanted to waive his Miranda rights and make a statement. He then reiterated that invocation when he said he would only speak in the presence of a command representative. The Norfolk police detectives failed to scrupulously honor Appellant's invocation, and they immediately questioned Appellant about his invocation of his right to remain in silence. When they then directed Appellant to remain in a closed interrogation room and decide upon a course of action after he had already invoked his right to remain silent. And when they finally asked Appellant if he would be willing to take a polygraph examination concerning his son's death.
How are those facts of yourself in the interrogation, assuming that you're correct that the unambiguously invoked his right to remain silent, how would either meeting him in a room or asking if he was willing to take the polygraph resumption of the interrogation?
Your Honor, specifically asking if he was willing to take a polygraph under the Supreme Court's decision in Rhode Island versus Innes.
What about the under that decision under footnote 5? How was that answer, yes or no answer to that question, likely to be permitted in
front? Your Honor,
if it was not, how would the resumption of the interrogation?
Your Honor, I would invite this Court's attention specifically to the interpretation of Rhode Island versus Innes by the First, Second, and Third Circuits, specifically the First Circuit in the United States versus Ortiz, where that court determined that a police officer's reinitiation of questioning of a custodial suspect who had already invoked his right to remain silent by asking the suspect if he wanted to cooperate with authorities was the functional equivalent of an interrogation. I think that's perfectly analogous to the question of whether the appellant in this case was willing to take a polygraph examination.
In your view, what is the breakpoint in this case? The critical breakpoint? Is it with the invocation, the signing of the rights warning? Is it the bathroom scene, the polygraph scene? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I believe I do.
What is the critical factual piece to this that we should be focusing on? The Norfolk court seemed to think it was the invocation of no, which came over. Is it the bathroom scene later that opened up the door to a cleansing warning, or what is the critical break point?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that all of the actions of the Norfolk Police Department demonstrate that they did not scrupulously honor Appellant's right to remain silent, but Appellant invoked that right, and the most important moment was when he wrote no on his rights advisement. From that time on, he should have been free to leave and should have been released from the police station. Any further interrogation, any further actions on the part of the Norfolk Police Department never should have taken place.
What if he reinitiated? I'm not saying that happened, but are you saying game over? Or would it have been possible, as a matter of weeks, legal theory for him to reinitiate?
Certainly under Michigan versus Mosley, Your Honor, an appellant can, or a suspect can, reinitiate questioning. In this case, the actions by the police officers in this case, never ended, never terminated the interrogation at all. The interrogation continued, essentially, for the entire time that appellant was in custody.
Didn't they, in fact, tell him they couldn't talk to him because he'd written no on the form?
They did tell him that, Your Honor, but they did not cease talking to him.
They did not cease talking to him. Well, as a follow-up, Judge Ryan already asked this question. How is asking to get polygraph interrogated?
Well, again,
Rhode Island being
an interpretation under specifically United States versus Ortiz. Also, the second and third circuits in United States versus Tyler and United States versus Montana as well.
Okay. Didn't he eventually execute a complete waiver?
Later on.
Justice Wyden seemed to think that's enough.
Your Honor, the Collins position that Michigan versus Mosley clearly says that it is...
Are you saying that the waiver was no good because his will was overborne, or why?
Absolutely. The reasons were improper as well. Appellant unambiguously invoked his right to remain silent when he wrote no on the rights warning.
Well, do you disagree with the entire line of cases from the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit Court that whether a indication of the right is ambiguous or not is a question of fact? And then when you have a situation like the one here where a person at the police station is telling the police from the beginning that he wants to talk to them about what happened, he wants to talk to them about what happened, and the only thing he did, and then he puts no. You don't think that they're allowed under case law to ask them why?
Depending on the circumstances, I do think that it can be proper to ask it.
So what is the fact that this case made the question, why not, improper?
Well, initially, Your Honor, the statements that appellant made in this case, stating that he wanted to speak with the police detectives, came prior to his rights advisement. And Michigan versus Mosley, in the cases that interpret Michigan versus Mosley, say that the important question is whether what a suspect says immediately after he is given his rights warning.
Right, except it's what he said before that made what he said after the rights warning ambiguous. Do you disagree with that?
I certainly understand the argument that his saying he wanted to speak with police detectives and then saying he didn't want to speak could be seen as ambiguous.
What about what he said afterward, when he told them, I really did want to talk to you?
Well, at that point, this was a conditional but unequivocal statement that he could only speak in the presence of a command representative, Your Honor.
That's not an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. It's making a condition. I want to talk to you. I want a command representative to speak. It has to be an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent.
The appellant agrees, Your Honor. I would respectfully disagree that this was unambiguous. And ambiguous means open to more than one meaning for interpretation. And saying, first, no, I will not waive my rights, and then saying, I will only waive my rights in the presence of a command representative, is not open to multiple interpretations. The police were unwilling to provide appellant with a command representative, and therefore appellant was unwilling to speak. And as I stated in my brief, Your Honor, it would be no different than if a suspect were to say, I will only speak upon a grant of immunity.
This doesn't appear to be correct, or whether the refusal to command representative was a ruse or was actual policy, or does it appear correct?
Both detectives, I believe, Your Honor, testified that it was Norfolk Police Department policy not to allow anyone else in the interrogation room except for an attorney. Certainly, they cite no regulation, and it's unclear, but they do testify that that was the policy.
The CCA states that both parties have the judges' findings of fact to be accurate and not clearly erroneous. Is that a fair statement? You can speak only for yourself, of course, but do you agree with the CCA's characterization that the appellant does not challenge the findings of fact?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. Can you break down the bathroom scene for me in terms of indicating what is happening? Is the appellant reinitiating contact? Is the detective initiating contact? And or is the detective interrogating the appellant based on what we know from the record and what the findings of fact were with respect to the bathroom scene?
Yes, sir. The bathroom scene, Detective Mayer came to the interrogation room where Appellant had been sitting for a number of hours and asked him if he needed anything. Appellant said he needed to use the bathroom. And I think that statement very clearly fits under the Supreme Court's determination in Oregon versus Bradshaw, that there are some inquiries, such as requests for a drink of water or requests to use a telephone, and a request to use the bathroom is analogous, that are so routine they cannot be fairly said to represent a desire on the part of the accused to open up a more generalized discussion relating directly or indirectly to the investigation. So I think that would simply be what Oregon versus Bradshaw says, a simple request for a particular request to the telephone. At that point, he was brought to the bathroom and made another one of these simple requests, made a request to use the telephone. Detective Mayer said, you cannot use the telephone because I'm doing something. I'll let you use the telephone when I'm done with what I'm doing. Again, as I stated earlier, appellants should have been free to leave the police station hours earlier. So there is no reason that he shouldn't be free to use the telephone.
And the detective saying things come to him. In your view, is he initiating contact there? Is the appellant re-initiating, or is that interrogation, or none of the above? Is that a patent conversation?
Yes, Your Honor. Upon suspicion, that would be a re-initiation by the detective. He is re-initiating a conversation about the case. I'm busy doing something. Appellant then asked why he couldn't use the telephone, and at that point, Detective Mayer said, "Hey, sir, we have your wife here. We have her in the interrogation room, and we're giving her a polygraph examination." I think without a doubt that was a re-initiation by Detective Mayer.
Is that a statement that is likely to elicit an incriminating response or not?
I can certainly imagine that it's a tactic that the police are using in order to overbear Appellant's will, in order to get him to waive his rights and subsequently consent to an interrogation.
I say, this guy is a Sears school person. Do you think he's going to be overborne by that? Is that what we should be testing? Overborne? He'll be overborne by that?
Well, admittedly, he was a graduate of the Sears school. There's certainly no evidence on the record of how he performed there, and in fact, there's no evidence on the record of exactly what Sears school was or what he went through. I'm not sure that.
But actually, really, I'm asking you whether you should we be testing whether that amounted to interrogation or whether whatever was happening in the bathroom overbore, whatever the word is, his ability to make free choices.
Well, I
would say I
think it's both, Your Honor. If that is reinitiation of interrogation, I think at that point, Appellant's subsequent confession should be suppressed. But I think it also goes to repeated efforts to wear down Appellant's resistance and make him change his mind. And I think that the Supreme Court is clear in Rockland versus Innes that either of those are impermissible on the part of a police department or on the part of police officers. And I think they fall under both categories. In terms of these repeated efforts that the police detectives made to wear down the Appellant's resistance and force Appellant to change his mind, I think it started immediately with Detective Biden's inquiry as to why Appellant decided to invoke his right to remain silent. It carried on with their instructions that he sit in this closed interrogation room and select upon a course of action. Appellant had very clearly determined his course of action at that point. He said he would not waive his right to remain silent. He said he would only communicate with the police detectives if he had a command representative present. That is a very clearly delineated course of action.
With respect to his graduation from Sears School, doesn't this court routinely take into account commonly understood facts about military life? And why, under that circumstance, would we be prohibited from taking into account the nature of his military service, the specific schools he attended, and common understanding about his purpose at school in terms of teaching individuals how to cope with intense interrogation?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think this court is prohibited from doing so. I guess my point was that it's not clear on the record exactly what a Sears School graduate is taught. As a member of the military, I'm not entirely sure what goes on at Sears School.
Now, I guess you testify.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't think it's clear whether or not perhaps at Sears School, and I believe this is the case, that that people being interrogated are supposed to give some information at Sears School, but not everything or not important information. And certainly, that would violate a suspect's right to remain silent.
I understand the answer. Now, I'd like to talk about the findings of fact of Queen's law of the military judge. Earlier, you indicated that the defense does not have an argument with the findings of fact by the military judge. They should not argue today that any of these findings were clearly against the case.
That's right.
Let's look at Collins and I, showing Collins page 177. This is in regard to the point that you were making earlier, that when he provided the answer no to the question of whether he was going to make a statement, that was unambiguous, and you said that he had spoken earlier about wanting to make a statement. The finding of is that during the course of the Rights Warning Administration, that he repeatedly for the record. He said a number of times he wanted to talk to the detectives. That wasn't in an earlier statement. It wasn't during general conversation. As he was being given the rights warning statement, he indicated that he wanted to talk. Why couldn't the military judge take that into account in reaching his conclusion of law that the application of rights was engaged?
Well, again, Your Honor, it is Tom's position that the analysis begins after the warnings have been fully administered, not before they've been administered and not during the administration.
What case stands for the proposition that a trial judge cannot take into account the circumstances that take place during the administration of the rights?
Well, I don't think that any case specifically said that, Your Honor, but I invite this Court's attention to the specific language, not only in Mosley, but also to the two Eighth Circuit cases cited by the government, United States versus Johnson and United States versus Thompson. And they say, once warnings have been given, the subsequent procedure is clear. If the individual indicates in any manner, at any time prior to or during questioning, that he wishes to remain silent, the interrogation must cease.
Anything in those cases discuss the issue of ambiguity?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But if I may, just before the United States versus Thompson, Your Honor, it's very clear to determine whether Thompson asserted his rights to remain silent, we focus on statements made by Thompson immediately after receiving Miranda warnings. And it's Appellant's position that Appellant's statements in this case, immediately after receiving those warnings, there was one statement, and that statement was no, as in I will not waive my rights to remain silent. And at that point, there was no ambiguity. There was no other way of interpreting, pardon me, that statement, no, and he should have been free to leave at that point. I see that my time is all stuff, so if there are no further questions, I can please my
opinion. Okay. Two questions. Would you agree that before we get to Mosley, analysis that we need an unambiguous invocation for the right to remain silent and the presumption of interrogation that at that point we press to determine whether or not that interrogation is not in place with not respect the right to remain silent?
I agree with that.
Thank you, counsel. The court will not hear from counsel for you.
Yes to question 7 as well.
And if he said no to question six, the only correct answer to number seven is not applicable.
Which specific questions were intended to elicit an incriminating response?
Well, specifically, I would say the questions about whether he was going to take a polygraph and the question, and the, after he had learned that his wife also was going to be taking a polygraph.
And how was the response to, are you going to take a polygraph? How could that be incriminating response? I mean, the answer is either yes or no.
Correct, Your Honor. However, a polygraph is not admissible in court, and the results of the polygraph is. And the reasons for asking a polygraph, if someone wants to take a polygraph, is generally for intimidation from the perspective of the suspect. Because in this case, the lower court erred in saying that it should be seen from the perspective of the intent of the officers. But this, from the perspective of the suspect, when they hear polygraph, they think about, on television, they see the people, whenever the criminal is told, you have to take a polygraph, they get intimidated, they end up confessing, they cry.
Is there any case law to support the proposition?
About the polygraph?
About the inherent quality of polygraph question. Not my question given in the course of polygraph exam. Right. Any question as to whether one will submit to.
No, Your Honor, I do not believe so. I'm simply relying on applying what the perspective of the suspect would be in this case at this moment.
Irrespective of what his perspective is, with respect to whether a polygraph is somehow intimidating or something that you hear, you're not arguing that that somehow transforms the answer to the question into an incriminating response, are you?
Well, actually, that, Your Honor, yes, I am with an additional fact about
the... Okay, let me, before you get to the additional fact, if the answer is to, do you want to get, if I will take a polygraph, is no. How's that can't be introduced?
It is not. But just because it's possible that somebody can answer no and not incriminate themselves doesn't inherently make the question not for the purpose of eliciting an incriminating response. Because no matter how hard you try, someone can always say no. But the additional fact I was speaking about was that the detectives had told him that his wife was in there and was also going to be taking a polygraph. And I do have a case law regarding that. In U.S. versus Miosevich, the Third Circuit, in 1988, the police used the threat of charging a member of the suspect's family as a ruse to induce him to surrender the right to remain silent he had previously unambiguously asserted. And in U.S. v. Charlton, in the Sixth Circuit, 1977, the defendant declined to waive his rights, and shortly after, an agent came in and said that they had his son, which caused the defendant to begin talking. And it was held that in both of those cases, that the right to remain silent had not been scrupulously honored.
Counsel, my recollection is that those cases were not cited in your brief, now it's appropriate if you cite cases in response to questions. Do you have citations for those cases, perhaps?
I do.
You can provide them subsequently.
I can provide them later, yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
You apply a backwards approach in your brief. Is that approach designed to get at whether the statement was voluntary or whether the implication of the right to remain silent was scrupulously followed, or whatever the word is?
The factors, from the most important Watkins court, the factors you're speaking of?
I'm on page 8 of your brief, right? Yeah, sure, that's Watkins. You're citing the Watkins.
Right, these are factors to determine whether the right to remain silent has been scrupulously honored.
Now, is it consistent to test whether something's been scrupulously honored by coming up with some factors? Do you think that's a logical relationship? I'm not asking you about your brief. You're applying the law as you see it. But I'm asking, if something's being scrupulously honored, is it consistent to then come up with eight factors to determine whether something's been done scrupulously?
Well, yes, Your Honor, the factors are necessary because it needs to have a guideline as to how to determine whether something is scrupulously honored. Because every case is different, and so we can't have just set rules, because set rules can produce...
So scrupulously honored doesn't mean scrupulously honored. It means what Justice Blake ultimately said, which is the text of voluntariness.
Well, it means...
That's a question, not a statement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're supposed to respond in some interesting way.
Well, scrupulously honored is the ultimate goal of the law, but these factors help us in determining whether it has been scrupulously honored. These factors give a guideline to how to determine scrupulously honored, but somewhere above.
Why should we look at factors? Shouldn't we be able to tell right away whether something's been done scrupulously or not? Does that have to do with weigh different factors and so on?
No, Your Honor. I believe that in order for it to be consistent and for different courts to come up with, for different judges to come to the same opinion, that there needs to be some sort of guideline so it's not just each individual judge's random belief about it. Not based, there needs to be some sort of guideline as to what factors need to be considered.
Thank you.
Well, the Watkins decision refers to time periods that have been committed to complete initiations, being shorter than 1 or 2 hours. Does that establish a ceiling, a floor for a ceiling, for the minimum time that's required, or can there be time less than that?
There can be time less than an hour,
about 35 minutes.
Yes, but there can also be time more than an hour that doesn't follow that.
Well, what about the time period in this case? What impact do you get the time period in this case?
I believe that the time period in this case was 35 minutes they were leaving to let him consider their latest question. So they hadn't ceased questioning. They were letting him consider their latest questioning. So this 35 minutes wasn't really a break in the interrogation. It was just a continuation. And, Your Honor, I noticed that I have 30 seconds left.
You can take the time necessary if there is another question. And if not, you can take the time necessary to sum up your argument.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Are there any further questions?
You may sum up.
All right. Thank you. So the defense, therefore, requests that the court reverse the decision of the lower court and set aside the finding of the sentence in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. The court will now hear from the counsel for the government.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge. May it please the Court. My name is Major Elizabeth Harvey, along with Colonel Louis Polio. I represent the United States. If the lower court was correct that appellant unambiguously invoked his right to remain silent, which the government did not concede, then the lower court correctly applied the principle of Michigan v. Mosley to the facts of this case, determining the detective's due scrupulously honored his right to cut the question.
Let's go back to that a minute. The government doesn't concede the TCA's finding to the fact that it was an unambiguous statement or again, an ambiguous indication. He didn't appeal that, so isn't that a law of the case at this point?
Your Honor, the government did not appeal it, did not appeal that point in an otherwise incorrect result from the CCA. However, the law that you adopted states that once the case is before this court for review, you may consider an erroneous conclusion of law by the lower court, which the government would report that that was based on the facts in the record, the facts show the conflict.
And what is the standard that we look at there? I mean, do we just look at that as a, if we were reviewing the normal error that they feel, or is there a higher threshold? Is there an assessment initially, or are you not?
What's the government's response that the matter is law theory? Understanding that there's a difference between the parties on whether the right was invoked and if so when, and so whether it was sufficient, but stipulating that a right was invoked, the right to silence was invoked, is it possible, in your view, and based on what theory, to reinitiate questioning in the context of the silent interrogation? Most of the cases that deal with reinitiation have some temporal break, but also physical break. The person goes back to their cell, the person goes home to their apartment, whatever. What is your, you see my question, where there is a continuous interrogation, is it possible to scrupulously honor the right to interrogation within the context of a continuing interrogation? I'm not getting, trying to get you to say that's the extent. I'm just trying to get you to answer the legal question.
Yes, Your Honor, and the answer is yes. The Michigan versus Moses will expressly puts the issue within the constraints of Miranda, which is custodial interrogation. So it necessarily implicates cases where the custody continues and the reinitiation of interrogation occurs while the suspect is still in custody. So,
what's your best case that you both were looking at when we, if we were to get to that issue? That was the one you were in.
United States versus Sue, which is a Ninth Circuit case, was although there was a temporal shift there, but it was within the car. I mean, they drove the car to a different location, but certainly the suspect remained within the custody of the same individual was being questioned about the same offense. And so being parked in a different parking lot outside a home versus the parking lot previously had been.
Your point is there was no break in police contact in that case?
Yes. And it was, I believe, less than 30 minutes between.
Because Mosley is a very different factual pattern.
Yes.
The military judge found and the detective admitted that at least at the beginning there was no probable cause to hold the cell. No probable cause to arrest. If was this custodial interrogation at all?
Your Honor, because the way the detective testified that the level of, I guess, layers between the appellant and his ability to leave, he would have had to knock the door, he would have had to have been escorted in, all of them could leave. They did read it as far as danger to be treated as though he's in custody, although they say he wasn't officially a government.
If there was no probable cause to arrest, then how does anything come in under Dunaway?
Your Honor, I'd have to look at that after this
meeting. What is unambiguous about this situation where initially he says no, and then the police officer asked, well, why are you saying no? And he said, well, I don't want to command the presenter. That answers that question as to why he said no. It pretty much clears up why he's taking that position. At that point, why isn't there an unambiguous no?
What the detective testified to was that he said, I want to talk to you, but I want to command our president. They said, well, we can't let you have command our president. Is there anybody else that you would want? He says, no, I want to talk to you, but I want to command our president.
Okay, and that just stopped right there.
Yes, sir.
So what's that ambiguous about? I mean, he has said, he has made his position pretty clear. He's not going to talk unless there's a command representative. They said, we're not going to give you one. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Except that he still said he wanted to talk. The detectives say, look, we're going to give you time to think about this and figure out what your decision is, because it still seemed to be...
Doesn't that imply that he made the wrong decision? to invoke his right. He invoked his right, and according to the CCA, it was unambiguous at that point. And then the police officer said, oh, I need to think that over. Is that appropriate?
Your Honor, the testimony from the detective was that he still said after they told him the handwriting was going to be available, that he wanted to talk to them.
Where in the time of the fact that he was trying to just say, no, I don't know, or say, no, I don't know.
The military judge didn't mention that at the time of the fact, so he decided to interrupt the detective.
Okay.
Can you break down the accuracy as much as the appellant did? Let's say whether there is or is not a conditional invocation of the right to remain silent. Later, there comes a time when he's in the head with Detective M. And what's going on there? Is he initiating, or the police reinitiating? I think it's the exchange of questions, interrogation. What in your view is the legal significance of what occurred in the bathroom?
The first couple of questions are clearly neither interrogation nor reinitiation. When he wants to go to the bathroom, when he wants to use the phone. The response by the detective, you know, I've got something else I'm doing right now, is not a reinitiation, it's interrogation.
Why isn't that an effort to elicit the question, why, what are you doing?
It is basically, I mean, the call asks me to use the phone, he's going to do something right now, I can use it when I finish what I'm doing. Whether the appellant...
What did most people ask, what are you doing?
How did it come out that they were going to, that they were going to expect polygraph? Who initiated that in that sequence?
He asked the next question, which is, what is going on? And the detective then told them, well, your wife is here and she's ready to take polygraph. That is also not interrogation, right? That is something that Justice Powell alludes to in his concurrence in Edwards, something that is alluded to in the concurrence in Mosley, which is a statement of the facts that they now exist presented to the appellant, and it is not necessarily interrogation for the detectives to say, for example, in another case, your co-conspirator was just found and he's down the hall.
So is the focus then on not whether it was intended to elicit something, but whether it was intended to elicit something that was inculpatory?
Whether or not it was intended to elicit an incriminating response.
And in your view, counsel, leaving aside the question whether or not the communication of the right-wing challenge was ambiguous or unambiguous, do you need the appellant's counsel to agree with federal injunction of interrogation in this case prior to the second right to form the right to complete the paragraph?
Mayor, the government doesn't believe that interrogation as the officer's intent is defined it was ever reinitiated to the point where they sat down and received the right.
Counsel, when an individual's question, remember they're forced to question by another individual's forces, and that person is a suspect. There's no requirement for the being in custody before questions are asked the right before race warnings are required. The Supreme Court in Miranda cited Article 31, but decided to draw a different line. The Supreme Court in Miranda said, in civilian life, and questions are being done by people not connected to the armed forces. They'll only require race warnings when a person is in custody. And why is that? Why did the Supreme Court focus on custody for purposes of our own laws?
Sure, they focus on it because of the inherently coercive setting of being in custody, of not having control of the situation, of the temporal nature, the location, those types of things that police necessarily
can call them. And what's the best case for the proposition that when a person is in custody in an inherently coercive situation, the police can nonetheless continue to ask the person whether they wish to make a statement after they made an unambiguous not want to talk. I recognize the governor is conceding here, but for purposes of this question, let's assume unambiguous implication of rights. What case do you rely on as the best one from your perspective that a person in custody can nonetheless be reproached?
United States versus citizenship.
And for purposes of reapproaching someone, what conditions can be maintained at that point? And that is it simply in custody? Is that all that matters at that point? Or can the police apply additional coercive measures or intimidating measures? And of course, the guest can push the where they want to go to work.
That would play into the most in principle this idea of looking at the totality of the circumstances. It's not so much an issue of, for example, in this case, whether the polygraph question was itself interrogation. The issue is when you got to the point where he did waive his right to remain silent and did agree to his statement, was that because he wanted to make a decision, or was it because the police officers had persistently worn down his resistance? So in this case, the government doesn't believe that any of the actions the police took here wore down his resistance, that his decision was his decision when he decided eventually to waive his right to be contacted with his wife.
Is the government's position that the term scrupulous, state honored, is men in the person's place yesterday indicated they do not want to speak, or they want to speak under conditions. They placed in a nice lady and they have to go through two security orders to get in there. That's what is required before they leave that room. They're not allowed to make phone calls until there's a time and place that they're choosing to leave. Not allowed to speak to the spouse except for the time and place they're choosing to leave. Police. Not allowed to have more representative present. Those factors all constitute scrupulously honoring the individual's statement that they don't want to speak.
Yes, Your Honor, because the action detectives took in relation to asking questions about this offense all scrupulously honored his right to that question, even though...
My question is, does the creation of that atmosphere constitute scrupulously honoring the individual's statement that they do not want to speak?
Yes,
sir. In the government's view, then, at what point would the person in that context continue to leave? On the theory that all persons at some point will break, could they leave him in that room contemplating his invocation for 10 days, provided they were feeding him well?
Clearly not, Your Honor. And again, it's one of the circumstances that that plays into the overall idea of whether or not they were attempting to wear down his resistance. Again, there's no bright line, but some extensive custodial period where they just talked in every hour, every couple hours, and said, "Are you going to talk to us now?" No, okay, and then come back and leave them there. Certainly would pretend to appear to be efforts to wear down these.
How much time are we talking about here? 5 hours? 5 hours total.
35 minutes from the first invocation until the polygraph question, and then another 2 hours before the trip to the
How long after that? That was really frightening.
They started questioning him, I believe, within about 15 minutes of the trip to the bathroom where he said that he wanted to talk again. They brought him in and began the process of the pre-polygraph interview, the polygraph, the post-polygraph interview, and then eventually the interview.
How does a person get out of this situation? Any person. Is it incumbent on them, having invoked their right to remain silent, to request to leave and see what happens? Why, you see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Is it when he feels tired and it's midnight and he thinks maybe I should go home and sleep now? Or how do you get out of that situation if the police are just waiting for him to be considered? No coercion, no nothing. You're just saying, we'll wait him out and eventually he'll say yes.
Well, Your Honor, there's no, obviously, there's no burden placed on the suspect to take the mandatory to be able to leave. But I guess, but rather, when we're in a situation where there has been, at some point later, been a statement, we look to see how long the period of time was, and we look at the circumstances in this factor.
Didn't the judge find that one of the policemen said that he would have done anything within the law to keep him there?
He did, Your Honor, although...
How does that cut?
Your Honor, that goes for the fact that he was in custody initially at the trial level.
Well, I guess he was in custody and he couldn't leave.
Yes,
sir. Okay.
Counsel, I'd like to draw your attention to Detective Byron's testimony. And according to this testimony, he said, just sit here for a minute, get yourself together. I left the race plan in his presence. I said, go over and determine what you want to do, the first action you want to take, because you're saying you want to talk 15 minutes from now. Just sit here for a minute, a second to a minute. If you come to a decision, it's not coming to work. What's the impact of that on an individual when the individual's told, just sit here for a minute?
Where they left him to put the back to him was when he had made a decision, he was to knock on the door. He had knocked on the door. As time passed, 3 or 5 minutes later, they came in and asked about the polygraph question, but I'm not sure, Your Honor, that the words "you can sit here for a minute" have an effect on volunteers by themselves. The issue was that the police officers didn't feel that he was making a decision one way or the other, which goes back to the argument that it was an ambiguous assertion of his right. And therefore, they wanted to give him a chance to look at the form and figure out what his decision was.
I mean, doesn't, and what did make it find the fact that the team leader, after they had this call to you about, you know, making decisions, and basically, you know, made the decision, instead of saying, no, I haven't made my decision, or saying, you're all accused, it constitutes beginning a conversation by saying, my son was with a babysitter for 2 hours. And the detectives at that point don't jump on that and start talking to him, instead they leave him be.
Yes, sir, and absolutely under Oregon versus Bradshaw, that statement itself seems to be a renegotiation by the accused of the detective he had gone in and continued questioning on care. However, I think it's another example of these detectives, they were scrupulously honoring his right to cut off questioning, that they wanted to give him a chance to definitively figure out what it was he wanted to do, because the events go back and forth while they're giving him the request.
Can we give any weight to the discussion in finding fact 19 to the fact that the accused said, you know, later this point, he said he wanted to take a polygraph, and he said he wanted to talk to the detectives. The detective said, no, you really know, so we have to revise him, and then the accused said, quote, that he had been confused about the right to form, wanted to waive his right to take the polygraph test.
That's right, and that can work in any way to get to that about what the earlier statements meant. Here reinforces the position that it was an ambiguous indication, and in fact, if you look at the record, what this detective says is that the appellant said, I wanted to talk to you guys before, but you wouldn't talk to me. And so when you look at, you know, his back and forth, yes and no, you look at the statement he tried to give his detective to try to walk out the door, and then that statement later that he had wanted to talk to them certainly doesn't reflect from the appellant's point of view that he thought he was invoking his right.
But couldn't finding the fact 14 be read in another way? In other words, he just made a statement there that my son was with the babysitter for about 2 hours, which may well be a statement. So, I mean, couldn't that be seen as the detective having succeeded in getting a statement from him that at that point, if the CCA is correct, he made an ambiguous indication of his rights, they should not have done it.
The question, even if you believe that he unambiguously wrote the word no, the questions that were sought to clarify that, no, we're not in and of themselves interrogation question with what I was just going to say. So.
If they elicited an answer, they couldn't be interrogated. How would you deal with that?
Your government's position is that the way that the testimony plays out, the findings of fact are that this was a freely given statement, completely voluntarily given by a client as respected to walk out the door, trying to cut off any questioning, and it wasn't a response to anything that was kept.
Counsel, you have an opportunity to see the question I asked, the rest of the judges may ask, and then you also have an opportunity to see the question. With respect to finding 19, one state that you were confused about the right point, not related to the right point, what specific statement in the record did you point to this court that client would have said he was confused but wanted to now make a statement? Thank you. I'm kind of confused. I thought, no, I was confused. I told you guys I wanted to talk to you, but you guys didn't talk to me. Why doesn't that show a continuing ambiguity that was resolved only upon further opportunity to discuss that was provided by the defense?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the most important point here is that this ambiguity, it was not continuing, but it only developed after the repeated efforts by the police detective to wear down the power's resistance. I think this is
the sort of... that's not what the testimony of the detective said. She said, I'm kind of confused. When I put no, I was confused. Does that indicate in a temporal sense that the ambiguity existed at the time and was putting the word no on the form?
Well, Your Honor, even the testimony of the appellant was that at that time I was confused. That's not what was in front of the Norfolk police detectives at the time. They saw no ambiguity. They saw the answer to the question was no, I will not waive my rights. And then they heard the, when they further interrogated him about why he was waiving his rights, they heard the conditional statement that I will only speak in the presence of the command representative.
So it's the defense view that, you know, the detectives believe that he was confused because of his previous statements he had as well. And the accused later stated to the detectives that he was confused at the time he put no on the form. Even though both were confused, that the word no was uttered.
We are in a position that what the detectives couched as confusion was actually simply disappointment that the accused had chosen, or the talent had chosen to invoke his rights.
I just don't know what it is or to do when we have facts like the Department's case where you have someone come into the police station and he's telling the police that he wants to talk to them. He says he wants to talk to them. He never says, I don't want to talk to him. He says, I'd like to have a man representative for her. The police backlog, they could get an impression in, and there's plenty of cases where that happens, right? They're threatened, of course, they were, and instead, they back off. And then he later says, reiterates that he's confused.
Yes, sir.
And they execute another rights policy. And so, what is it about the police behavior in this case that you would point to as being a confusing wrong?
First and foremost, the panel should never have been in that interrogation room any longer. As the Supreme Court before the Michigan v. Mosley, I think as this court interpreted Michigan v. Mosley and Watkins, an important factor to look at is whether or not the accused or the suspect has been released. And that was a tremendous factor that both those courts looked at in determining that the ultimate statement was voluntary and that the police had scrupulously honored this indication of defendant. In this case, appellant simply should have been released rather than have to sit in that interrogation room with the instructions that when you decide on the course of action, knock on the door. I think Judge Erickson made the point earlier that the clear implication of that is you have made the wrong decision. You will sit in this interrogation room until you're willing to talk to us, until you change your mind. There was another
question.
Yes, sir. Okay,
what's the ultimate policy, legal policy goal here?
To ensure that an invocation of rights is known voluntary in the court.
That the invocation of rights is?
And respected by the police.
I mean, I understand your point about someone being in custody, but I mean, in this particular case, where the defendant's in fact arrived at the police station at 1500, the first hour of that period of time is dealt with during the forms, having nothing to do with the interrogation, having to do with things that need to be set up because the sun is set, right?
I don't know if the first hour, Your Honor, certainly there was a body identification form to be filled out.
Was it at 1550 after the sound body identification form was used for the process, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so that's when...
Yes, Your Honor, it was at 1550 that he survived.
And it was at 1835, so less than 3 hours later, approximately 3 hours later, the second form was looked at, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we're talking about a 3 hour period of time in the police station.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I recall that there was a testimony requesting the parents to come down and fill out the body identification form in order to get them to the police station?
Absolutely. certified identification